Okay, this is talking with Dr. Stanley Evans on 11 March 1981 at the Engineering Department at Cambridge.
Yes,
well, can you tell me, first of all, what's your educational background?
Well, I'll give you the basic dates through that period you're interested in, 1950 to 1960. America.
Okay.
1948, I was at Manchester University reading physics. And the summer of, it would be 1950 because I graduated in 51. So the summer of 1950, I went to Jodrell Bank to do a VAC job. I mean, I specially asked to. I knew the research was going on there. Lovell, Clegg, in fact, lectured to us that year. You know, Clegg,
yes. I've never talked to him, but I know who.
Oh, well, he was a marvelous teacher still.
Well, I don't know.
He was at Imperial College.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, Clegg particularly infected us with him. Yes, this probably is rather. Clegg was the electromagnetics side of it,
mm-hmm,
at Jodrell Bank. He taught us particularly in the physics course in our second year at Manchester, and so I pleaded with him mainly and subsequently with Bernard Lovell to go and work there during the summer.
What does VAC refer to? I'm not
familiar. Vacation.
Oh, vacation. No,
so I did a summer VAC job, working with Jerry Hawkins at stage,
oh, yes,
using the radium meteor experiment. I think it was with me. Yes, it was. I got to know him well then. And as a result of that, I set my sights on going there as a research student,
yes,
the following year. Didn't get a very good degree. Had to plead with them again, but managed to get my, whatever it was then called, DSIR grant.
Right.
So went in the summer of 51 then.
Can you tell me about that first summer that you were there? What was the atmosphere like? What was the main thing that was going on and so forth?
Oh, I think meteors were then in the ascendancy to a lesser extent. I mean, particularly things like these routine radiant experiments that Hawkins was doing. Greenhow, who's now dead, was doing steerable antennas built on the, mm-hmm, searchlight base. Meteor velocities in particular. John Davis, there are two John Davis, the elder John Davis.
I have talked to him.
Yeah, he's probably still there.
J.G. Davis.
Yes.
Me.
But
who's the younger? I don't know of him.
He went to Bristol on meteor cameras.
I see.
And he was called John Davis too, but without the E in the Davis.
And then Rod Davis was there.
Davis, yes, came from Sydney, didn't he? Anyway, Greenhow and Davis Senior, were specially interested in, they were going into what, we made some distinction between meteor physics and meteor astronomy, meaning upper atmosphere studies on the one hand, mainly, and meteor astronomy at that time meant meteor velocities and radiance, and the controversy with Erpic about whether they were interstellar or not.
Right.
And whether any were, and then it developed into whether any were interstellar or not. Clearly,
right,
showers were not.
Right.
So
who were the leaders of the
Davis and Greenhow?
Was it split up that way? Ionosphere was one group?
No, they were all techniques for meteor velocities and directions, and therefore the Greenhow in particular developed the apparatus for what you would call individual radiance, the direction and velocity in space, the velocity and direction in space of individual meteors instead of just a shower. So you could decide if any of them were extra
solar system.
Yeah. That is. And that involved having three space stations.
And how far apart, roughly?
Oh, a few kilometres. One I seem to remember was probably at Lovell's house.
Mm.
But anyway, a few kilometres.
Do you have any memories of passive observations with Hanbury Brown? I believe he was there at that time, was he not?
Yes, what sort of memories do you mean? He was doing the Dick radiometer.
Right, but wasn't that the hole in the ground dish built?
It wasn't a hole in the ground. It was the one looking vertically.
Yes.
It was built above the ground, wire stretched over a frame. That was the very first one to be built to look at cosmic rays. What it actually saw first was a Jacobinid shower in 1946, I suppose that would be, or 48.
46 it was.
Yes, right. It was the big repeat of the Jacobini. And that was when they knew they were looking at meteors for certain, and not cosmic rays.
But I'd forgotten that.
The vertical-looking dish with a single steel tower was single wires, not mesh, stretched over a lot of poles standing on the ground. Oh, it wasn't a hole in the
ground. Thought it was a hole in the ground. No. Okay.
And then it was, then by the time, by about 1951, Hanbury Brown had largely taken that over for vertical, what was then called cosmic noise observations.
Right.
Is that what you mean?
Yes, exactly. He did the Drama Nebula and things like this at that time. Mm. Okay, so you began then in 52, was it?
51.
51 as a research student.
That's right.
And you continued working on meteor radar problems?
I was given. You asked what determined what you did.
Right.
It was determined by the supply of research students and the supply of apparatus and direction, principally from almost entirely from Bernard Lovell. Here was one man, Davidson, Leon Davidson, working on a height-finding radar for meteors. He only had one more year to go. Somebody must overlap with him to keep the experiment going, the apparatus going. That's how it was decided.
I see. And
it's probably true all over.
Well, not that you should make an independent choice at such an early stage, but...
Well, it varies in different sciences, doesn't it? Well, that's pretty general in physics and engineering.
So you then primarily, for all the way up to your dissertation, did you work on this kind of problem?
Height-finding.
Right.
Meaning antennas arranged so you got the angle of elevation, and you measured the range, so you got the heights of the... Well, in the first case, the specular point, but then we did a bit more. And the idea we got, I was supervised by Tom Kaiser, you've met him?
No, I haven't, but I know who he is.
He's absolutely key. You haven't met John Clegg, you haven't met Tom Kaiser.
Well, remember, radar astronomy is not my key thing.
Yes, well, Tom Kaiser
at
Sheffield, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And we got the idea between us that the distribution of heights was related to the properties of the upper atmosphere, pressure and temperature. So we're getting out pressures and temperatures.
So you were using the meters simply as a tool to probe the...
Simply as a tool. Well, yes, we didn't know what we were using them for in the first place. They just wanted to measure their heights. Then we said, what can we do with these?
Right.
We can find out the properties of the atmosphere.
Right.
And the parallel investigations at that time were meteor photography by Whipple and Co.
Right.
At Harvard then, or Smithsonian, whatever it was.
Well, both.
And V2 rocket experiments in New Mexico. So we're all comparing results, those three techniques.
Mm-hmm. Did you have close tie-ins at this time with the people that were doing the passive observations, or what, were they pretty separate?
So you
groups?
Are getting on to the sociological aspects.
Well, I don't ignore them. Right.
Well, I think what might be quite relevant to you is... it is a social aspect, but it's also important technically. There was tremendous sharing of detailed experience and knowledge of techniques, both electronic and electromagnetic. I mean, all the groups talked together very closely all the time about how to do this, how to make antennas, how to make transmission lines, how to make your electronic circuits, how to make your recordings. Very close cooperation, and that might be a social aspect.
Well, no,
I think it's important technically. That's how technical knowledge developed.
Right.
Talking between all the groups.
It wasn't a matter of each group had its own equipment budget and they got
As far as the budget went, it was autocratically administered by Lovell, and that meant everybody did work together.
Now, did this spill over also into the scientific results that you were getting? Did you frequently discuss with people about the cosmic noise, and they discussed with you about meteor results?
I think, in retrospect, there might have been a fair bit more effective, what do you call it, interaction there than I perhaps realised at the time, because, you see, the meteors were used to investigate winds in the upper atmosphere, the trails drift. So were the cosmic noise observations.
The radio
you see
star.
The space station with Maxwell and who was his first main research student? I think So there were the space station meteors and the space station cosmic ionosphere, both trying to measure winds and comparing techniques, realizing they were measuring different things, right, and how different and how to relate. I think
when you say space station now, you're getting into the...
A few kilometres apart.
Space station.
Space station. Oh, no, sorry.
Well, that's what I thought, okay. Right. And of course, the influence of these on the radio source work was, in particular, was quite important, of the ionospheric effects on the radio source work.
Yes. Right. Scintillation was right. Maxwell's line, you see, and right, all that you could do with it and learn from it.
Now, I've never heard of this fellow Maxwell.
Oh, yes. He was doing radio star scintillation.
He was doing scintillation. Oh, Alan Maxwell.
Alan,
of course.
He's somewhere in the States.
Oh, yes. I've talked to him many years ago. I just had a lapse. Going back to the equipment, can you tell me what were the principal limitations of what you had? What were the principal problems that you were facing from day to day? Yeah, technical
problems.
Right.
Electromagnetic problems, by which I mean antennas, transmission lines, waveguides, transmit, receive switches, all the stuff that hung about outdoors. The technical problems were, the techniques were very well understood by Kaiser, Clegg, Herlofsen, and to a lesser extent John Davis, came in later on that side. Things just needed making, but one knew how to make them.
So there were no real problems with the frequencies that you were
No, this was all...
Was this still surplus equipment?
30 MHz, 60 MHz, 120 MHz. The transmitters, the high-power transmitters, were very much surplus equipment adapted.
And what about the aerials and so forth? Did you build them?
It's just a lot of ironmongery.
Yeah, okay. Now what about
And a lot of wood there. There they developed with wood, here they developed with Dexin.
Right. Now, there's a good difference between
Dragon
and Candy.
Yes. Coach bolts and 3x2s. Because that was the men in charge of the workshop worked in big balks of wood.
What about the receiver side?
But electronically.
And the display and the processing of
yes,
the data.
A lot of hybrids with surface equipment taken over. You see, the range resolution you're asking for didn't put great demands on the bandwidth. Valves, as they then were, could easily cope.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of time was spent just bending metal, punching holes, wiring up valve circuits. But broadly, you could make them do what you needed then, mm-hmm, the resolution you needed then. I mean, you're talking only about bandwidths of probably, less than a megahertz.
Yeah, so it wasn't a critical problem.
No, I mean, you're talking about ranges of hundreds and sometimes thousands of kilometers, you see. There's no bandwidth. Bandwidth is the usual technical problem, isn't it?
And
well,
what
it
about,
has been for the rest of my
right,
life.
Right, you didn't have this problem of wanting to have the very largest bandwidth that passive people.
No, that was when Henry Brown started, first of all, the video correlation, and then when he started the photon correlation.
Right.
I remember how extraordinary it was then for him to think of building an IF strip with 40 megahertz bandwidth.
Really?
And it filled a post office rack. And that was really, beyond the current state of that bandwidth.
Yeah.
Now, which you needed.
Well, let's go now to the third phase, I would think of it that way, of data reduction. And was it such that you quickly became inundated with data and you had to spend several months working on it, or was that a problem?
Yes, my own particular records were a little bit... first of all, photographic films, so, quite often each night we spent developing photographic films, long old 35mm film. These were read in a microfilm reader. Read meant tracing them onto tracing paper, a lot of dots on tracing paper, measuring these with rulers, planimeters in my particular case, finding areas to average and things. Yes, it was what would nowadays be considered ridiculously long-winded, what I've always believed useful in that made you stop and think what you were doing.
And you had a much better
feel. So, I mean,
feel
I have, for, wasn't I have great belief in long-winded data production myself, but today I'm fashion.
Yeah.
Now, it wasn't automated beyond that. You developed film, you projected it in a microfilm reader, you traced it onto tracing paper with a pencil sitting in the microfilm reader, you measured off with all the basically rulers, and then how on earth did one do calculations then, I suppose, with logs?
Tables and slide rules.
Yes, slide rules, yes. That's right. You plotted graphs.
Now, when did you actually get your PhD?
55. Because...
And you hadn't worked on anything in the passive.
That was all meteor heights.
Right.
Entirely. Upper atmosphere properties.
Do you remember any conferences that you went to during that time that might be of interest?
Two, I think, at Jodrell,
yes,
which
right.
The real excitement was the Russians came at that time.
And what do you remember learning about from their visit?
A few came from Cambridge. Of course, the meteor conferences, the Cambridge people weren't interested in.
Right.
So I can't remember why they
there were. There was the IAU, General Radio Astronomy Conference, in 1955. I think that's the one.
By 1955, I left. It must have been the beginning of 1955. I left.
Oh, I see. This was
for the first time.
This was summer of 1955, yeah.
And went to work for the Royal Navy.
But let me just go back to that about the meteor conferences. Do you remember?
I don't remember going elsewhere.
I see. So,
but
there was one at Jodrell in 1953 or so.
Yeah, I may have gone elsewhere. I can't remember.
But do you remember any highlights about important papers or? Or critical issues that struck you?
Not related to the conference, but the exciting new things then with a meteor, individual meteor radiance. I mean,
was that considered important mainly for this problem of do they come from outside the solar system?
Yes, as far as I remember. As far as I remember.
Yeah. Well, that's always understood. So you went into the Navy upon getting your degree.
Yes.
Right, and. Then apparently you got back into radar astronomy by 1958 anyway, when I see you have a paper on lunar radar. So how did that come about?
The sociological aspect of that was that my external examiner at Manchester was J. Ratcliffe, perhaps met here, still lives on Huntington Road. And he was at the time thinking about recruiting for the Royal Society, who were doing their IGY Antarctic expedition.
Oh, yes.
So he must have made a mental note of me and wrote to me within the year saying the Royal Society were recruiting, was I interested? And he knew about it in Cambridge because James Wordy, who was then Master of St. John's, was chairman of the Royal Society, it's called IGY Committee or Antarctic, IGY Committee.
And this would be for ionospheric research?
This was building their Antarctic base.
Oh, I see.
And for me personally, I was in the advance party, so I was meant to be a general scientific factotum. It was mainly building the base. The main party were coming in the year afterwards.
Okay.
What I actually took with me was upper atmosphere was the link.
Right.
Auroral camera.
Mm-hmm.
Ozone spectrophotometer. Something else, but it was all upper atmosphere, and something else related to the aurora, and starting the aurora radar. So it related to the upper atmosphere,
right.
And that's why I was there.
And so you did this for a year or two?
I was only down south 1 year, because the main party came in then with a much bigger scientific team.
And did you then go back to Jodrell after that?
Yes, that's right.
You had to get back by 58.
No, before that.
Oh, I said by 58 you had
yes,
to right.
Must have gone back in 57.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 57.
And did you find that the place had changed very much in what was going on? And
well, the moon work, which is what I went back into, had been going on before with Sandy Murray at Malvern.
I haven't talked to Sandy Murray at Malvern.
W.A.S. Murray. He was doing the moon before. Presumably still at Malvern. And he'd left by that time, the time I came back. And meteors had been wound down very largely, been worked out very largely at that stage.
When you say worked out, what do you really mean? That there
well,
were
that
no
was
more
the feeling.
No more interesting problems?
Yes. Yes.
And
it's all what they say.
Why do you think this was so? Was it just the nature of the beast? Or was it such
well, the problems about the upper atmosphere, we'd gone as far as we could with upper atmosphere properties. The V2 rockets were doing more. Winds had been done as far as they could be done with meteors, I think. Whether they were extra solar system had been settled. What else was there?
Yeah. Well, I guess
Aurora had been a parallel interstellar time because it used a similar apparatus. That was the reason.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you.
So Aurora radar went virtually to Alaska, didn't it?
And that did continue after the meteor.
Oh yes, I mean that wasn't going to be a worked-out subject. No. Jodrell wasn't a very good place for it.
Not far enough north. Yeah.
I mean, they got a few basic things.
So you went back and you joined this lunar radar
and,
group.
Hormans, yes.
Was this working on the Mark One? Or also with other?
That was going to be 120 megahertz on the Mark One, yes. And just as with Baus, he'd done quite a bit before I came back. And very shortly after I came back, the first Sputnik was launched. And this, our moon apparatus was rather suitable for that too, so it was largely taken over for that.
In terms of just tracking it and
yes,
getting its orbital parameters and so
yes.
forth. And
so.
How
so
far
it changed in that meteors had been fairly deliberately wound down. It's thought there was quite a lot to do with the moon. But the apparatus proved to be the best then available for Sputnik tracking.
Right,
so quite
right.
A lot of effort went into that.
And I think that was published in Nature, finally, at least a report
yes,
was published
yes.
there.
Yes,
And did you take part in that?
Oh yes, that
the
was very cooperative, yes. I mean, Lovell was so excited about it, he was able to call in many different groups.
Mm-hmm. So he was very keen
on these. There were a lot of cooperative papers, weren't there? There was one actually labelled Staff of Jodrell Bank as the authors.
So. Mm-hmm. So what was this, an intensive couple of weeks of just trying to learn everything you could about the satellite and its orbit?
Intensive year, I think.
Oh, that long, really?
Oh, yes.
But Sputnik was, the first one was only up for...
Yes, then there was another one.
Right,
there,
that's right.
Yes.
So, I see. So you went that long, yeah.
Yes, and then the...
this is all using the Mark
American
One?
Yes,
right.
The American team from Jet Propulsion Laboratory came in the second one.
I see.
And they were using Mark One, too.
Was that the first instance of Lovell getting American support? At all for the
well, I don't know what you include in support, but personnel coming in deliberately
yeah.
and working
well,
on it, that's the first I can recall.
Or
yes.
any funds, yeah. I mean, you know, something that...
Yes.
Because later on, of course, there was a...
Sure,
later
yeah,
on, there
I
was,
don't know what else.
Yeah, later on, there was a lot of NASA
yes.
involved.
Yes, I think it definitely grew from that particular beginning.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the main purpose of the lunar radar observations?
Well, that's where it started. I don't think one knew. It was just a difficult job,
just
so
to do
not
it.
To try.
Yeah. Yeah.
There'd been some very weak ones before, but they came to the conclusion that the fading rates were quite a lot could be done from fading rates. One thing which could be done was some of the details of the moon's motion. That's the
libration.
Which is this one, the rocking.
The libration.
Is that the libration? Yes.
Yeah.
There are several components of that, some of which are not very interesting, because they're caused by the Earth's rotation for the first to start. Better ways to do that. But some of the minor points of it were interesting for the moon's motion. But the major parts of the moon's motion, and the most obvious thing to do by radar, is measure the range, isn't it? So it was valuable to know how the moon reflects,
mm-hmm.
so you know what you're measuring. You see, it was a very academic approach, as it should be anyway. Here was just a difficult thing to do. Let's try.
And then derive from it what
and
you could.
And what can
yeah.
we get from
yeah.
it? No,
yeah.
it wasn't a question of setting a problem and solving it.
Mm-hmm.
But the accurate ranging, which therefore relates to the astronomical unit, doesn't it, came quite a bit later. It was realised, you know, that's not so... That the obvious thing to do is really rather difficult.
Well, it got more and more accurate as time went on.
Yes.
I know at the same Paris Symposium, in fact, that the NRL team,
yes.
Minneapolis.
Several groups were thinking of that by
working
that stage.
On the same approach.
Yes. And I think we decided our apparatus wasn't suitable for that, and probably our resources weren't. But it was something to recognise what the problem of determining the astronomical unit this way, what it involved.
Now,
we certainly learned. It certainly helped learn that.
It's puzzling to me that lunar radar had not been done much earlier in Java. Do you have any thoughts on why that was?
Well, they got apparatus going by in 1951, I would think.
Well, was it that
certainly
early?
Certainly Murray, yes.
Okay, well, I had forgotten it was that early then. And
worked with no particular object other than to get a sufficient signal to noise
right.
ratio.
And it worked. It went on continuously through the 50s. Then.
Yes, I think so.
It was only that you joined up with
him in
57.
So. Yes.
Okay, well, I'll have to definitely talk to him.
Well, there'll be a thesis of his.
Well, in fact, I'm going to go up there in about a month, so I can.
There'll be a Murray thesis.
I can check that out.
I'm not going to read that for you. Mm-hmm. I'll look at it. And there'll be his papers, too.
Yeah, sure.
I'll look under that name.
Now, I only found this one lunar radar paper of yours. Is that correct?
I think that would be the only one.
So does this mean that you changed it again?
Or
were you doing other things that didn't involve writing papers?
I think all that time I was back there, so it was only 57 to 59, and I think it was dominated by Sputnik.
That's your memory, I see.
Yes.
And were papers published on this in detail in various journals that wouldn't have been in my bibliography?
I shouldn't think so. I mean, I just think there might have been as many as half a dozen. Two or three, anyway.
Yeah, right. Okay. And so this was really applied research, one might say, to follow this, but you see how satellites drag.
Yes, I mean, we had some of the most suitable apparatus, and again, it was just, it was good publicity. I think that shouldn't be ignored.
Well, okay.
Lovell will think along those lines, very successfully along those lines. It was just exciting for us to do. I mean, we just
right.
thrown in front of us, and who knows?
Well, okay, this is another question broaching on sociology, is that I agree with you wholly, and it seems to me that that Lovell and whoever else was making the decisions was not, did not mind at all going into something that was not really pure science.
No, I didn't mind at all.
So what would you say would be his criterion as to what's useful to work on?
Don't feel I can give a good answer. I mean, the main thing was he got excited about things and was able to
went out and did it, yeah.
infect everyone else with that.
Yes, so I mean, so you were quite excited about doing this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You didn't feel like this was, since this is not real scientific work, that it's
something...
No,
he was much too dominating a character to ever stop and think that.
No, I mean you.
I know.
Oh, I see, you didn't stop it. Okay. Now, did you change fields yet again after the Sputnik period?
I came to Cambridge in 59.
In what field?
That was because of my Antarctic experience. The Polar Research Institute here got in touch with me.
I see. And then what kind of research did you begin here?
Wasn't at all clear. But I had lots of auroral records from... the Royal Society exhibition that hadn't been analysed, and I started on those.
I see.
And the rest of that story is very strange, but probably irrelevant to you.
Right, but since that time, you've never drifted back towards radio astronomy in any way?
Not so far off, actually.
Not so far off.
So I'll tell you very quickly, very briefly, that story. The auroral photograph. Related to wind, well, motions in the upper atmosphere, it turned out, auroral motions. I started with photographs. I went on to the auroral radar results that had been obtained by the main party at Halley Bay. So one or two auroral papers, and I was talking to the ionospheric people, and the key man interested in it at that time was Piggott, who was, first of all, with the radio research station at Slough, and
yes,
just
I know
the last
name.
Few years worked for British Antarctic Survey. And he produced ionospheric records from Halley Bay, which showed curious interference patterns, which we talked about together until we realised that not only was... Do you know the story? Not
well,
only
from
the
was the transcript.
Oh, yeah, right, you know it. But that meant I got interested in propagation through snow and ice, which I worked on several years, which turned out to be rather easy because, well, nobody else was doing it, basically. But very exciting.
Right, but it was a whole new technique. Completely new. Yeah, right.
Yes,
right.
That's been tremendously productive too. Fading a bit now. I also got the general idea, but that was out, I mean, that was about 12 or 13 years ago, and came here and had the general idea I've worked on since, if only you could do the same thing in materials which are more important than snow and ice, it would be rather useful, and that's the sort of thing that I think about now. It involves very much the same techniques, but updated by 25 years, or 10 years.
Right.
Which is radar, but very broad band now, and relatively low frequency, for propagation through, well, hopefully rocks and soils, hopefully concrete.
Mm-hmm.
You might not think that's radio astronomy, but techniques.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
I talk to radio astronomers quite often.
Yeah. Well, okay. Let me ask
a question about whether aperture synthesis was basically developed in radio astronomy. He thought that it was, especially as the military used it today. And that's the end of the interview with S. Evans on 11 March 1981, also the end of the tape.